Well, in the second hour of the program, as part of our Election 2000 effort, we are going to have an open line, and you can call in and ask the questions that you would like to of David Phelps, who is the congressman from El Dorado, Illinois. He represents the 19th Congressional District, which encompasses the southeast and part of the east central counties in Illinois, roughly from Coles, Clark, Moultrie, and a good part of Macon County, all the way down to the southern tip of the state, the southeastern tip of the state, which includes his home area, which is in Saline County. David Phelps is a lifelong resident of El Dorado. He was a public school teacher and assistant principal in the Harrisburg School District after being graduated from Southern Illinois University. He was appointed in 1980, getting into politics, to fill an unexpired term as the clerk and recorder in his home county, Saline County. And he was elected to a full term in 1982 and then went on and scored somewhat of an upset was elected state representative as a Democrat in a heavily Republican area that had been, he defeated the veteran Republican state representative in an upset in 1984 and went on to serve as state representative until being elected to Congress in 1998. Serving on the Agriculture and Small Business Committees in Congress, and he is running for another term in Washington now. Yesterday, you had an opportunity to hear from and call in and talk to the Republican challenger, James Etherly. But today, we will be taking your telephone calls for the incumbent Democrats, David Phelps, and I have to make sure that I'm doing the telephone thing. Do I push the button on the bottom? Is that the one that I do to put him on? There we go. We should have David Phelps on with us. David, good morning.
Jay, how are you doing?
I'm doing fine. It's been a long time since we've seen each other, hasn't it?
Sound good, as usual. How's all your family and everybody?
Well, thanks. Everybody's doing well.
Good.
And
well,
yourself?
We miss you down here, but I heard you're doing a good job there.
Well, thank you. Thank you. Just to give you a little bit of background, I spent about 25 years in the broadcast journalism business in Southern Illinois, and obviously had quite a few times both professionally and personally meet with David Phelps.
We passed several times, didn't we?
Yeah, yeah.
All good.
And,
yeah.
So it's good to talk to you this morning. I was happy that that we were able to arrange this and make you available to listeners up in the northern reaches of the congressional
That's
district.
Important. Thanks for the opportunity.
Well, our telephone numbers are 333-9455 if you're calling from the Champaign-Urbana area. And then we do have the toll-free number for those in the southern reaches of the listening area, which include much of the 19th Congressional District, 1-800-222-9455. 333-WILL, 800-222-WILL. Will be the telephone numbers to call. One thing I did leave out, because I was talking mostly, David, about your political career, but you have also been involved for a long time in the Phelps Brothers Quartet, your gospel singing group, and you've also, as in your spare time, which I'm sure you have plenty of, written music for many artists, including the Oak Ridge Boys. And it's been somewhat of a tradition for you, I guess, or well, at least it was in the State House, for you to sing on the House floor at the beginning of sessions.
Yeah, that's been part of my life. My three brothers and I have been singing a long time since we were small children, so we still do it on a timely basis when it works out with all of our schedules. And it's a family affair, and it's a ministry of gospel music for us, and we have a good time still with it.
Great, and I still remember when you helped us out with the benefit that you performed for the fund we were starting down in Carterville, the educational fund. That we did the telethon for after the teachers had died.
Yeah, I remember
in
that.
The accident. Yeah, we did that through the Lions Club. And again, thanks for that. That was great. Well, let's talk about some of the issues as we wait for some phone calls. Some of the issues that are coming up in this campaign and this election year. You, first of all, have had very close ties to education. As I mentioned, you were involved in educational administration in the Harrisburg School District, and you have also played quite a role on the state government level in education as a member of the House. One of the questions which has come up in the presidential campaign, as education has become one of the topics of discussion, is what role should the federal government and what role can the federal government play in education, which is usually a matter for local school boards and the state, which is more directly involved in the funding and educational programs on the local level. How do you see the federal government's role in education?
Well, Jay, thanks. It's a very important question for listeners and the general public to be informed about their candidates on this particular issue. Education is probably the most talked about issue, and everyone, I don't know of one candidate that I've ever heard of since I've been in this business 20 years has said anything against education that it's not important. It'd probably be foolish to do that. So it's really recognized, and anybody that does any polls or stays in touch with their constituents would know that very obviously. As I was in the State House, the state representative, I was very fortunate to chair the Elementary Secondary Education Committee. And then as a teacher, my first job out of college when I graduated from SIU, I taught around 4 years and was assistant principal, as you said, in Harrisburg Unit 3 District. Valuable years, and my whole family, my other three brothers, were all involved in education. I have two that are presently public school administrators. My wife's a public school teacher, English in high school here in our hometown. So it's an investment that we must, you know, have a return on, and it's the best investment we can make for the future. I know that this issue, as far as how much involvement should the federal level play, is probably not a new issue. It goes back, and one of the things that probably perhaps maybe helped distinguish between the two party ideological stands is how much government involvement in any area, let alone education. But I just happen to believe, Jay, that that most, and I mean a big majority, of what happens in education does belong to the authority of the state. Mm-hmm. And they should legislate and direct their funds according to the priorities of the people in the state. And that those that represent the general public would be reflective, I'm sure, of those priorities. So, and that's happened, I think, the 14 years I served in the Illinois House. However, I believe that the federal government does play a role on a universal level. You know, when we have children that graduate from our states, our little communities within the state, they end up competing on now not only a national but international, global level. And to say that that one state might not measure up to competition of students that maybe have more resources or may have advantages in whatever area that might be, whether it's computers, technology, puts some students at a compromising situation. And so there's where the federal government should play some role and establish some uniform measurements, some achievement of skills that are at least uniform throughout the nation. And, whether it's reading, whether it's writing, math, there ought to be a standard level in which we expect students at certain levels, certain grade levels, to be able to at least reflect in a national test. Mm-hmm. I think that's only logical. And so, therefore, I think right now the federal government, we distribute and fund to the states around 8% of the funds for education, which is not a large amount. I think we ought to do a little better. But that's not to say, we should have some strings attached to some money that we put to every state and say that there should be a measurement level of expectations that the taxpayers have in all children in every state, where there may be one state that have a big edge and a advantage, we want to be sure there's money that shows at certain basic skills are reached at certain levels. Head Start is a good example of what I think is a good program that gives kids an equal opportunity at a certain age, preschool and otherwise, to have that equal basis of opportunity and to get started in a right way. Even if we try to do that from equal funding measures, we know there's still going to be some disparity out there because of the mere fact of tax bases that are better than others, some states that are richer, and whatever other demographics that are hard to control, and we should not necessarily mandate control. But we need a general uniform understanding that basic skills are to be expected at certain levels, and measurements should reflect those.
Mm-hmm. Now, connected with that, if the federal government does dictate that this is a basic level, it's obviously going to take some work on the parts of some districts to get up to that level for any number of reasons, which may be socioeconomic, it may be geographic location, it may
right.
be the tax base or whatever. Should Congress then put the dollars behind it to fund whatever's necessary to build the programs up? Is that a national thing? You know, if you put the mandate down, shouldn't the dollars follow?
Yes, they very much should, and that's one of the biggest failings of not only federal but state government. You know, there were state mandates that were unbelievable. That's not even reflective of the federal government. When you get into special education and areas like that we know there are special needs and efforts that are expensive, for that matter, to make sure that all kids, because of their handicap or disabilities, should not be left out of the mainstream and be treated like all children. So, you know, those are questions that come into debate. But I feel that at the same time we have strings attached, as I said, with some funding that shows that the school districts in these states should measure up to at a basic level our expectations uniformly throughout the states. At the same time, money that we send, laws that we make that force school districts and states to measure up to certain levels should have enough resources. And there's wherein lies the toughest part of trying to find a balance. While we've got to have people that work together in Congress that come from all diverse kinds of diverse situations, different states, like you said, different kinds of resources and contrasting things to work with versus a poor state or poor school districts within the state, and trying to get all that equalized is one great challenge. And are there going to be some mistakes made, or should there be improvement? Yes, there should, and constantly that's what we should make our business be about. And so mandates without funding is not good government. That has happened, but, you know, when you I had different constituents to, when I had town meetings, I had them to list and point out what those mandates are. And when it comes right down to what the mandates without funding, there's not very many people that can list a long list, if much of any, that is mandated without some funding. Now, is there enough funding? Becomes a debate, but mandates without funding, period, are very exceptional, and I'm sure there are some that can point out a few instances, but for the most part, the programs that are priority and are focused on problematic situations have some funding. It's just a matter of how much mm-hmm. that we need.
333-9455 in the Champaign-Urbana area, or 1-800-222-9455. You're invited to join in this discussion. We intended to be an opportunity for you to ask the questions of the candidate that you would like to hear answered. Often we hear people saying that, reporters just don't ask the questions that I want answers to. Well, this is an opportunity for you to call in and ask a question of Democratic Congressman David Phelps, who represents the 19th Congressional District and would like to have another term in that office. 333-9455, 1-800-222-9455. And, Congressman, we do have some callers lining up, so let's take one on line one, if you will, right now. Hi, you're on the air with Congressman David Phelps. Go ahead, please.
Hi,
line one.
Rumsfeld. Let me give you three hardball questions about education. First, to remind you that no place in the federal government are there mandates for standards of any sort. So what is being suggested at the federal level is just only advisory testing. And so I'm sure you know that, and I just wanted to make sure the viewers were clear about that. So the first part of my concern is that we understand that the tests that we currently have now are very thin, and don't measure very well the learning and reading, math, et cetera, and the sciences particularly. They're very poor in the social study areas, and that's true of also our state tests. While they measure, they are not the final answer to the accountability question. So the first set of my first concern is you address the question of how will we make sure that testing increases to be useful for accountability. And the second part is to look at the question of input into the standards of a political and religious side, which I know we've made fun of Kansas for taking of evolution out of the standards, but in Illinois we have taken the word evolution, though not the concept, out of the standards. And so what's your thought about that? I know you come from, you said, a religious background. And thirdly, I wanted you to give you the hardball question of what do we do with special ed? It is exceedingly expensive, as you know, and we can't continue to fund it at the level we have. How will we ration that? And since I'm on a cell phone, I'll listen a little bit, make sure you heard that, then I'll get off.
Okay. And did you get all those?
Well, the first one I need to be reminded of, he asked about the measurement being how it could be accurate, right? If I heard it correctly.
Sure. Well, yeah, the gist on the first one, as I got it, was first of all, that the federal tests are basically, the federal government's
advisory
only, not,
yes,
not mandates. And that the current tests, both federal and state, aren't necessarily good measures.
Right.
Of learning and thus accountability.
Right. Well, sir, thank you for your questions. They're very, very direct and to the point. That's what I mentioned when I said that very few people in a town meeting, when you ask them, give me a mandate that you're upset about, there's a lot of hem-hawing around and they can't focus on, because, quite frankly, there aren't, like you said, many. There are a few mandates. You and I could discuss that a lot of people would not maybe recognize as mandates, that where you and I think of in a frame of mandates. But there are some. If you use special education money and American Disabilities, you know, there are mandates. But as of you and I are thinking of them in the span of mandates, how they're interpreted, they're practically advisory. You're correct. And I think that, you know, should we make that tougher or more direct mandates? Well, to me, it's a matter of money again. If we could produce enough revenue to make sure these mandates, without a doubt, and these states and school districts had the resources to work with to create the expectations we were gearing up for the mandates, that'd be a different story. But I think what we're looking at from a federal standpoint at least is a pattern, some sort of idea, a general idea of what's going on out there, because we know that the situations are so diverse with each state and the contrast that we have in demographics and the capabilities and the resources and all those things, which I think the federal government realizes. And to do anything else, you know, then you get into micromanaging, which the states are going to, object to. So there's a fine line to how much we demand versus how much we're giving in order to for them to answer those demands. And that will always probably be I'm not trying to beg the question, I'm just telling you that's the eternal challenge we've had, and I'm not sure if that is going to change. Mm-hmm. Special education is expensive. When you're talking about some of these children with the extreme problems that we see, and some have minor problems in comparatively speaking, but still have needs to be addressed and need special help, we're talking about one expensive endeavor. And that is why the funding levels, which are not excusable, should be excusable, but why they have not reached the effective levels, because it is a matter of competition of funds. You know, we're taking from one pocket and we're allowing the other areas of general classrooms and measurements and things that we ask for kids to participate in and to reach achievement levels to, can suffer from, because we're you know, reaching from one pocket and putting in another. Mm-hmm. So to be able to have a sufficient amount of funds is really what it gets into. And there has not been, at least when I represented the state of Illinois as state representative, there was not, general agreement, consensus, in the Senate especially, that we should increase the special education funding, because then you got into how we get more revenue for education. Mm-hmm. And then you get into the debate that still exists between property taxes versus education being funded by income taxes or consumer taxes or whatever else that's on the table. That always has been part of that debate. And the second question, what was it, Jay?
Well, he was wondering about the politics of religion in education.
Yes.
And some districts or some states removing the word evolution, but not right. necessarily effectively removing the concept of evolution.
Right. From education. You know, it's ironic this day and time that's those that seem to be the most avid from a religious philosophy and want values to be highly on the scale of importance in the schools are the very ones that are talking about that pretty much have already embraced looking at private and Christian parochial schools. I haven't given up on the public schools yet. Those that have taken their children out for whatever reasons, that is their business and so forth, and I understand that. But, you know, I just feel like that separation of church and state is still very important. Let me just tell you that I do understand the outrage, and I myself reach a very concerned level. My children are pretty much through school. I got my last one still in college. But, you know, I feel like that, you know, if we have language in textbooks that talks about, you know, evolution, many people in the religious world think of evolution as wanting to defer people's beliefs from God or from the creation. Well, that's a misunderstanding. But if you look at some of the textbooks readings as we have before our children now in the last several decades, it does lead one to believe that that is all they are trying to teach, is that we have animals, we have the human species that has gone through all kinds of evolution, evolved through looks, through different shapes, size, and forms, and adapts to all kinds of different situations because of the climate factor. Mm-hmm. And all kinds of things. That's part of education, and I don't think those can be disputed. But to look at evolution in a context saying that we came from amoeba and there was no creator involved in putting this world in order is where I think some of the religious setting has a good reason to challenge education today in the public schools, because they should not necessarily be mandated to mention that God created this world, this whole universe, and everything that we know about, but at least that should be open for discussion, and teachers not prohibited to let children express themselves and saying, this talks about evolution, but you know, I believe this, all of this was created. Now, how is evolution in the order of creation? That's the way we should be mm-hmm. discussing it. Although there are some people that just don't believe, you know, in God. Period. Now, should we all of us not be able to talk about what we believe strongly in a classroom setting just because there are very few that may not believe in God, period, and yet they want us to believe that evolution is more than just a change of species, that it was a matter of how life started. Mm-hmm. So there's where the dispute is. But I would like to keep church, you know, even though I think the discussions about those things should be open and not prohibited, about the beginnings of God and whoever believes that in the classroom, and be able to dispute and debate evolution from the meaning of non-sacred from the standpoint of God's beginning. But, you know, beyond that, I don't remember ever having prayer in the classroom in my K through 12. I remember prayers at the graduations, but I don't remember. And I remember having preachers at our ministers of a different faith would come to our auditorium, lyceums, and gatherings when the whole school got together for whatever assembly. But there was not a matter of classroom prayer. We did pledge allegiance and things of that sort. But I never felt like I couldn't pray, and no one prohibited me from doing that before tests or at my locker or in my room at my desk or whatever. But it may not have been out loud, and the teacher didn't direct it. So there's where we get into difference, you know.
Yeah.
You know, prayer in the public school, as a lot of people want to have it now, has never been there anyway.
Yeah.
And these, as far as these kids, these problems, the school shootings, they're bringing these problems with them from home. And the very people that are really insistent upon this being part of the curriculum, although I sure uphold prayer in every way of voluntary form they can in their whole day, to be able to have that part of the curriculum and mandate that to be part of it is not where I want prayer to be taught my child. If I can't do it at home, in the Sunday school, in my church, in my home, you know, what's he doing at school trying to make a display out of it if that's the purpose?
Yeah.
So, you know, we get in all kinds of debates on that stuff.
Sure. Well, let's take another call. Congressman David Phelps represents the 19th Congressional District and is a Democrat from El Dorado, seeking reelection. And the phone lines are open at 333-9455 or 1-800-222-9455 for calls for Congressman Phelps. We have a caller from Urbana online now. On line two, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hello. Do you have any influence in the Senate financing committee that covers the Medicare? Because there is a movement to reduce the money that goes to pay for cancer chemotherapy.
Okay.
Well, I don't serve on a committee that directly works on Medicare, but ma'am, as a member of Congress, I am a member of the Rural Health Caucus, and one of the things that we have really discussed this session is trying to restore any cuts from Medicare that was maybe overstated in the Budget Balancing Act. You know, when they balanced the budget, that was in 97, just prior for my entry into Congress, which I believe, you know, and would have supported the Balanced Budget Act. But
there's a OSCA, that's a website.
Okay.
And the purpose of this was to save Medicare a bunch of money because chemotherapy is very expensive.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
So, and they said that they had a October 1st deadline. Well, it hasn't happened yet.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
But it's something to be careful about and watch out for, because
right,
what would happen is a lot of cancer centers would have to close.
Right, ma'am. I hear you, and that's very important, and it's priority, for as I'm concerned, that we salvage and restore the levels that are necessary to treat people in the catastrophic terminal diseases, and that is very important. Let me just tell you one of the dilemmas that we're facing, though. You know, years ago, and the funding levels of Medicare that's being fed by the revenue and how we all pay for it and check off when we're working Social Security as well as Medicare. And the way that's working, and originally, you know, we didn't have the capabilities, technology, or the medications all these medical breakthroughs were not in existence. And so the pace of feeding the revenue that's feeding the source of Medicare is not necessarily keeping up with all the treatments and procedures that we have available, and medications and everything else that's expensive because it's been through research and new breakthroughs that thank God for all that's happened. Mm-hmm. But payment for all those, procedures is a great challenge with the pool of funds that we're looking at. And so that's why this surplus funds that we're having, we can't squander that on other programs to be sure we stabilize Social Security and Medicare.
Let's take another call from Martinsville, Illinois, on line 4. Go ahead. You're on the air with David Phelps.
Yeah, hi. Thank you. There's a lot of crude oil production within your district, and even though prices have rebounded lately, this industry suffered irreparable damage, which has led to a loss of 2 million barrels a day of domestic oil production. And I just wondered if you support measures that would promote an increase in domestic oil production, including marginal well tax credits, and please specifically concentrate on domestic oil production.
Okay, great question, sir. I'm very supportive of that, and you can check the record. I've been co-sponsor of measures to help domestic oil, because in the Wabash Valley, in which I serve, in southern Illinois and central Illinois in the Wabash Valley area, coal, oil, and gas is part of agricultural products. As far as I'm concerned, that's why agriculture is king, and those resources are very valuable to our economy. Always have been. Do we have dips and rises in the production and activity of all those industries? I've seen the Clean Air Act take away almost over 5,000 coal miners, deep southern Illinois and some part in the central. Because of the high sulfur content and the compliance to meet the clean air standards, which is a shame. You know, we've got the technology now to take that sulfur out, and we're looking at the phase two of the Clean Air Act, and perhaps some of these coal mines can come back because of technologies that exist. But those utility companies had to invest in complying with the standards and chose not to build scrubbers and had to go switch to low sulfur coal, and a lot of them got long-term contracts, so we've got to get through all that to see what happens here real soon as we're approaching here in the 21st century. But oil faces the same reason I mentioned that comparison, is, meets the same thing because we have competition that's international and from foreign lands. And, last year in April when I went to Evansville, Indiana, and fly to Washington, D.C., I bought gasoline there 78 cents a gallon. And so here a year later, it's, got up to $1.85 over there. So it didn't seem like that makes sense because it's a volatile market. In that period of time when it was so cheap, it was good for the consumer. Our domestic producers practically closed down, and many of them still have not regained. And I've had met with them and in touch with the Oil Gas Association. In fact, I'm speaking at their regional, I think it's a tri-state meeting in Mount Vernon, Illinois, just the 20th of October, I think, a couple weeks from now. So to go over these very issues, but it's very important that we at least try to give them the tools where they can compete, because I don't want to get too dependent. We are too dependent on foreign oil. And if we lose our domestic capabilities, that puts us in, compromise our national security. So very good question.
Yeah. Hey, thank you much.
Okay, thank you very much for the call. And we still have time to get a couple of more calls in. If you want to ask a question of Congressman David Phelps, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL locally. And anywhere else, you can listen to us on the air, 800-222-9455. That's 800-222-WILL. Well, Congressman, we got the news this morning that the Food and Drug Administration gave its approval to the RU486, the so-called abortion pill, yesterday. Those who are against abortion are vowing to fight that approval. Those on the other side of the issue are saying, including Eleanor Smeal of the Feminist Majority Foundation, that it represents a triumph of science over what she describes as, quote, medical McCarthyism, unquote. And this basically gives women in the United States access to a pharmaceutical abortion option that has been available in France, Britain, China, and a number of other countries. Just like to ask for your reading on this, your feelings along these lines.
Well, Jay, it's been very clear my record as a public official throughout my whole career has been a strong pro-life position. And I value life and feel like that the very moment of inception is when life should be recognized and therefore treated as such. We're going through, in this country for the last two or three decades, this issue has dominated the scene, especially on the political scene. But, right now the law of the land is Roe versus Wade. And I know that when it comes up for issues such as public funding for abortions, which I've resisted and I've opposed, and any of the other bills that have a direct impact on where your positions would be as a voting member of Congress or in the state legislature on issues that affect abortion, the fact of the matter is the law is that Roe versus Wade upheld and said a woman does have a right for abortion. I disagree with that on a personal level. And we'll try to resist legislation that I think threatens life at every level. This is an example of more of a diminished way that some people are trying to say is a danger rather than the first trimester, or as we saw the partial birth abortion has been part of our debate. Those are, as far as I'm concerned, are obscene ways to approach control of a woman not having a child. But, these medications, we're going to see all kinds of new technological medical breakthroughs that's going to make this issue a little more gray for some people, because they're saying, now what are you saying? It's before, possibly this is before the heartbeat, or is it? We're at least reducing by recognizing the very problem that people have in accepting that doing away with life. It still is a woman's choice, and that's what the whole debate's about. I feel like it's more than just a woman's choice. Yes, it's her body, and it's she's the only species of human that carries the baby. But there's some responsibility of, I think, the father, who has some authority and some decisions making it also, and many lives are ruined because of mistakes that are made and facing these decisions. But I've always been taught and believe that we get ourselves into problems, and we've got to be big enough to live and handle the predicaments we put ourselves in. Most of the self-inflicted problems that we have in life should not be determined by an easy way out, that especially when it threatens life. So this new drug is going to bring on a new wave of debate that says now we're at a very, very early, if not even before life is created, some are going to be able to say. I just happen to believe that if actual life was created the morning after with medication does not make it any better. Although I'll have to say, it's more disturbing to see when they're taking arms and legs out, of a mother by an abortion. And comparatively speaking, this may be less, resistant by some, and I'm sure that's the idea.
Mm-hmm. Well, we have a caller from Chicago on line four, and you're on the air with Congressman David Phelps. Go ahead, please.
Okay, thank you. Hi.
How you doing?
I want to return to the business of education. I'm originally from New Jersey. My older brother went to college down in Missouri. because that was the cheapest place in the country where he could get a college education back in 1940, 41. Paid about $10 a semester or something like that. And when he got down there, he found out that students from New York were so far ahead of everybody else in the country. This is students in the college that that all the rest of the students basically were handicapped coming to college in comparison with those from New York. When I came to college in Chicago in 48, 49, I found roughly the same thing, except that it was New York and California students who were so far ahead of the students in the rest of the country. Now, since then, well, during that period, at least in New York State, they were having regent exams for all public school students, and this is what kept the standards up and what kept the teaching up and so on. Since then, they've eliminated the regents, and New York State has fallen back with the rest of the country, and California has fallen back ever since Reagan was governor. He reduced funding, and it's they've been going downhill until this year, well, a couple of years ago. Now, what I find is that there's basically no will to provide sufficient funding for school in Illinois and most of the rest of the country. A year or two ago, the legislature and the governor were congratulating themselves because they were setting a minimum of $4,500 or thereabouts of funding for students, and this is insufficient to give anyone a decent education in Illinois. You have students up in rich areas like Glencoe, where something like $15,000 or $18,000 are being provided to students. They don't provide all that money in order to give them an inferior education. And what has to be recognized, I think, by you and the rest of the public and the Congress is that money has to be appropriated, and there's no way of getting around it, especially these days when we're up against our kids are finding facing competition from the rest of the world, and you're getting people not educated enough to fill jobs in this country.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Okay.
Well, sir, you said so much that I agree with that I don't know if I need to elaborate, but I'll just tell you that the first thing you stated was I think you painted a clear and accurate picture of the contrast and difference between rural and urban settings because, you know, I remember my father, who was born in 20, after going through the Depression, living in a rural setting, a farm, you know, states like Missouri and deep southern Illinois, where I'm from, you know, even right now, we haven't really tasted the what you might say the best of the economic times, comparatively speaking to the metropolitan areas. So it's almost like the good economy feeds the best well-established, and those that have been depressed may see a little bit of an improvement because of the good economy that rubs off a little bit, but never reach the expectations of what to look at from the standpoint of good economy, which then feeds not only your health care but educational institutions. Mm-hmm. So that's been with us since, you know, part of our history of our country, which is unfortunate we haven't gotten a control or grasp on that from the standpoint of equal education, because those differences do exist. New York versus Missouri, I can guarantee you there was a difference because I went to school with them at SIU, students from New York and Chicago, and versus little rural settings, we were at a great disadvantage in many ways. But, you know, after having said that, you know, here's what it comes down to as far as funding. You know, money is the answer. There's no doubt about that. But here's what makes it tougher from the standpoint of the taxpayers. And if you serve where I've served in the state legislature and chaired the Education Committee when the debate came about, and I supported Edgar in his endeavor to shift property tax based from as far as funding education to the income tax, I still think that's the answer, or better a way. I don't know if it's the answer, but it's a great improvement because people are concerned about we keep increasing education funding, whether it's to your level of satisfaction or mine, we do keep increasing it. And a lot of people in the general public are frustrated and say, we can't tell much difference. You know, you keep throwing money at this, and what are we producing? Well, you know, I think we're producing a pretty good product versus what we get from the standpoint of discipline that the parents send us in the way of their kids. Some of the problems that we have with drugs, not only with the kids, but the parents that have sent them with some of their handicaps are because of some of their, you know, you might say wild oats that they've sowed through the years. We got all kinds of problems in the public school system that a greater amount of money may or may not be able to fix. But we're sure not going to do it without revenue, that's for sure.
Yeah, can I cut in here a minute?
Yeah, quickly. We're going to run out of time in just a couple of minutes here.
It's only not only funding for the schools, but the parents have to be taken into account and helped. Many of them are so ignorant, they're no help, and they're a hindrance to their kids getting a proper education, and also the circumstances where the kids have to live in very poor circumstances, which is a hindrance to their education also.
You're exactly right. One of the biggest things, my wife is an English teacher right now. I just left her class and went by to get the automobile, and I needed to take the service, and she was mentioning to me about, you know, these kids that parents are, you know, insisting that they be in her high excellent standard class, one that's preparing for college orientation type English class, because they want their child wants to be, you know, looked at as, you know, as a high achiever, whereas they can't even handle the mid-level, mm-hmm. and the parents are not interested in, you know how the child is doing, what they can handle versus, you know, the trademark or the self-esteem that they're looking at is from a accelerated level.
Yeah.
So those are things that parents are going to have to cooperate with for us to be able to have quality teaching.
Well, we do have a caller that's just going to have to, hang, because we are just about out of time, and we apologize for that. But thank those
quick answer. You think, Jay,
who did get in? Well, if we can do it in just a minute, let's see. From Champaign, go ahead on line one if we can do this quickly.
Yes, I appreciated your remarks about your pro-life in all forms. What's your stance on then on the death penalty and war?
Oh, okay, good.
And if they differ from living, why?
Did he ask what about the death penalty?
Yes. Your stance on the death penalty and about war, and if they differ from a view on
pro-life,
pro-life stance.
Right.
Yeah.
I am for the death penalty, and I feel like that, you know, there's scriptural background and mm-hmm. support for that. However, you know, it's saying that some of the people that make the decision on who dies may not be any better than the person that they're making judgment on.
Okay.
But the good Lord, I think, you know, knows all about that and will judge us accordingly. But someone has to make order of things. There has to be rules. There has to be order in society. And some people have to pay the ultimate when they take the ultimate.
Goes against your stance on pro-life in all forms, then.
Yes, pro-life is, you know, from the standpoint of what I treasure in life. You know, sometimes you have to take a life to preserve a life. But that only has to be decided by the order in our society, not just someone making a decision themselves. There's all kinds of laws that have to be gone through, whether they be good or bad. But now we have technology that says, you know, DNA can also prove that you're innocent as well as guilty.
Okay. Well, we're going to have to leave it there, unfortunately, on that, because that obviously could be a very much expanded topic.
Starting to get to elaborate, and I'm sure he could too.
Yeah, but we do have to go. And, Congressman, it's been very good talking with you again. And
thanks
for making the time available.
I apologize for some of the longer answers. That these are good subjects and issues, and the callers are to be commended for their insight.
All right. Well, I'm sure we'll talk to you again as the campaign goes on.
Jay, thanks. Have a good day.
All right. Thank you.
Yourself, buddy.
Mm-hmm. Bye now. It's Congressman David Phelps, 19th District Democrat, and running for re-election. And the next opportunity you'll have will be coming up in October to again hear from the candidates in the 19th Congressional District. We'll tell you more about that. So stay tuned and listen.